Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. My guest today is Mac Stepanovich. He's a lifelong Republican activist with experience as a lawyer, lobbyist, and chief of staff for Florida Governor Bob Martinez. In the 2016 election, however, he was a leader of the Never Trump movement. He joins me to discuss the Republican Party and Donald Trump. Mac, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Well, let's look back just a little bit briefly here to give us a sense of where you're coming from in the conversation that we're going to have. Why did you join up with the Never Trump Republicans?
Primarily because Donald Trump isn't a Republican and he isn't a conservative, which I consider myself to be. And that's kind of on a policy principle level. On another level, I find him to be personally, as a man, very distasteful. And so I don't agree with many of his policies, and I don't like him.
So you voted for Hillary Clinton in the general election. Policy-wise, she was pretty antithetical to a lot of Republican views. So why were you willing to trade that in order to avoid things you don't like about Donald Trump?
Yeah, that was that's kind of the reverse side of the coin of some of my friends who voted for Trump even though they couldn't stand him because they could stand Hillary Clinton even less. My calculation was basically the same as theirs, but I came to a different result. I did not support her much. I didn't like her that much, but I liked Donald Trump a lot less.
And can you say a little bit more about some of the things about Donald Trump and the kinds of appeals or his style that concerned you the most and still concern you the most?
Well, on the personal level, the man is ignorant. He's a narcissist. He's a name-calling bully. And he's the kind of kid that I would have fought once a week in the fifth grade. And my daddy would have bought me ice cream for doing it. So I feel on pretty safe ground about that. On a policy perspective, as I said, he's not a Republican. He's a he's going to spend money like a Keynesian. He's going to increase the deficit. He's not supportive of a free press. He's he undermines democratic norms that I think are important. So from a policy perspective, he worries me a great deal as well.
You mentioned those norms. There have been quite a few writers that have observed and made arguments to the effect that there's something pretty dark that got tapped by the Trump presidency. Is that something that you see?
Well, that's really what I'm talking about. I have in things I've written and in other interviews I've given, and I'll talk about Trump having opened the Pandora box of extremists in the Republican Party. It is dark. I mean, for God's sakes, we're arguing about what the truth is when there's photographic evidence of what the truth is. We're all talking about millions of illegal aliens voting when there's not a shred of evidence that he did it. Alternate realities, we can't even communicate or agree on anything if we don't have a common set of shared facts. We don't live in a common reality. And I think he endangers those things, attacking federal judges for exercising their jurisdiction, on a very personal level. It undermines the process. And so I think all of those things are dangerous.
And again, some observers, some writers have taken this even to the level of suggesting that this is something that is reminiscent of some kind of version of fascism or neo-fascist in some ways. Do you see that?
I do. I have a tendency to characterize that minority of the Republican Party and those folks who aren't Republicans who support Trump with such fanaticism definitely have neo-fascist tendencies, whether it's an inclination to authoritarianism, whether it's a disdain for a free press, whether it's an apparent affinity for violence, whether it's xenophobia, nativism, misogyny, the whiff of racism. I mean, all of those are characteristics of fascism.
Now, in the end, though, in that election, most Republicans stayed home with their party.
That's correct.
So were you, with the experience that you have, surprised that more Republicans didn't make the kind of switch that you made in the general election?
Yeah, I was. Well, I don't know that I was surprised. I was certainly disappointed. I was hoping that enough Republicans would adhere to what is always have always been conservative principles, that they wouldn't vote for him. I didn't expect many Republicans to vote for Hillary Clinton, and that was one of the problems, was the Democrat nominee. But I had hoped that the others at least wouldn't vote for Trump. And at the end of the day, through a combination of Hillary hatred, aversion for President Obama and the idea that Hillary represented a third Obama term, and just reflex reaching for the at least metaphorical lever in the polling booth, they hit R.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with the Republican lawyer and lobbyist Mac Stepanovich. So you're a political strategist from a strategic point of view, thinking about the Republican Party. How would you assess how the Republicans in Congress are reacting to President Trump so far?
Well, I think that the House particularly is reacting positively because they have much smaller constituencies, and because of reapportionment, some would argue gerrymandering and reapportionment, many of them have heavily Republican districts. I read something the other day that said that Trump's approval rating is 54% in House districts that have Republican congressmen. Until that gets under 50%, they will play the percentages and not confront the president, which doesn't mean they won't slow walk him on some of these big spending items or other issues, but confronting him something different.
So you don't see then a strategic moment being lost here by not taking a more aggressive stance on the part of some of these Republicans then?
No, you might wish it, but that's not the way it's going to work. This will be a longer, harder fight. Trump will have to attempt some of the things that he said he would do, and then people will have to see that the results are not what was promised. It'll be a process. It's not going to be like there's some great Armageddon battle one Tuesday and on Wednesday everything's better. It's going to be like grubbing stumps. It's going to be hard work.
Well, on that exact point, if we think about the future of the Republican Party as an institution, how do you see it playing out here with Trump as president? I mean, some writers, observers have suggested that this could become his party in a longer-term sense in some meaningful ways.
You know, I think that's true, and that's really the issue here. Many people I know have already left the party and become independents. They didn't become Democrats. They chose to register into George Will, Sally Bradshaw in Florida, who's aligned with Jeb, Mary Madeline, who's a longtime Bush advisor at the national level. All those folks have become independents. I'm not ready to do that yet. I want to continue to fight for the party because I think it's important that there be a principled, conservative Republican Party in America.
Will the process of that struggle of whose party it's going to be, in a sense, will that be something that is going to be driven by one or two party leaders that are going to emerge and take this fight on, or is this something you see more as something that's going to play out at the grassroots level?
I think it'll play out more kind of at the grassroots level. I think it'll be more organic, and I think the Democrat Party has an important role in that. Until they start beating Trump-type Republicans in general elections, there won't be any penalty for being a Trump-type Republican. If you're going to, you know, we in the Republican Party who are remaining can bite at his heels, but we're not going to change the course of events. Republicans will have to be defeated for being Trump-type Republicans before their successors will move to the center to avoid defeat.
Now, a lot's been made of Trump's appeal in the election to the middle class and the working class. How would you see, thinking about this as a party strategist and messaging, how would you see a Republican leader tapping into that? Because the Republican Party has struggled in recent years to appeal to some aspects of those groups without getting into the bluster and the other kind of small d Democratic problems that you're associating with Trump.
I think that the answer to that really works on two levels. One's the substantive economic level. And what Donald Trump is basically proposing is a kind of protectionism abandoning what has been traditional Republican support of free markets, capitalism, competition. And what he's basically telling you, if you're a forklift driver at a closed auto plant in Michigan, I'm going to get your job back. He may or may not be able to do that. I'm in doubt that he can, because they would go to automation with some sort of assembly line run by a robot before they go back to a forklift driver. So that goes back to what we were talking about a while ago, is seeing what the results of all of this are as opposed to the rhetoric. On a different level, on a personal level, I think both parties need to be more respectful of those people and more understanding of the anguish which many of them really feel. I mean, grown men with families who have had self-respect and been admired and respected all of their lives, who've been out of work for years, whose children want to get away from that town as fast as they can. We need to be more understanding, and a lot of it, as I said, can just almost be rhetoric, just saying, well, as President Clinton once said, I feel your pain.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Max Stepanovich. He's a Republican lawyer and lobbyist who was a leader of the Never Trump movement in Florida. Well, political scientists, political analysts tend to agree that, on the whole, the Republican Party in recent years, last couple decades, has moved to the right as an institution, and it's become more homogeneously right. There's been studies of the voting patterns in Congress that show this, for example. And that's created some tensions for Republicans, even forgetting about Donald Trump. And it's created some tensions in upstate New York, up here, for example. I was wondering if you thought that there was some scenario or some chance that Trump and the political fallout and effects of a Trump presidency could somehow be a catalyst for more of a move back toward the center for the Republican Party. And in other words, if his effects might extend beyond his particular phenomenon to something that's a much more long-term trend for the party.
Yeah, I think so. I've done some reading as well on these things. And one of the hardest things for me is coming up with the right terminology, the right words to describe ideas and people. I mean, we have a tendency to use the word conservative loosely, I think. It's a very high-value word, at least in the Republican Party. And behind it hide neo-fascists, right-wing populists, and others. You can be a Trump supporter, and you can be a radical reformer. You can be an iconoclast. You can be a revolutionary. But you can't be a conservative. Conservatives conserve. And so I like to think of status quo conservatives who are not averse to change, but they like it to be controlled change, not disruptive change. Whereas opposed, you know, contrasted with the Trump and the folks who are his core supporters, they won't disruptive change. That's antithetical to the predisposition of status quo conservatives like myself. Then there's laissez-faire conservatives who want the government just to stay out of their business so they can make money. Trump's going to do some things like with protectionism and stuff that they may not like either. To the extent that he uses government power to enforce homogeneity, immigration policy being an example of that, that's how that'll resonate with those authoritarian constituencies. He may excite them, but it may not be as exciting to others who employ those people.
So if you as a Republican strategist are looking down the road, say 5 or 10 years, what kinds of basic, if you can put it in these terms, what kinds of basic political positions and appeals do you think would put the Republican Party in the best place? I mean, I know you've done some reading on changing demographics and how that relates to politics. Where would you be positioning if you were writing the next autopsy memo, so to speak, for the party? Where would you be positioning this party?
Well, as a conservative, first place, I wouldn't panic and run off in this direction or that direction. I would play a long game on this. And as I think it was Daryl Royal at the University of Texas once said when he was asked if he was going to start the fullback who had been such a good player for him all season long. He said he was going to dance with them what brung him. If I were a Republican strategist running races now, I'm a little old for that now, I would dance with what brung us. I would be a fiscal conservative. I would be a deficit hawk. I would be an opportunity promoter. And I would take a stand on values that I believe most Americans share. And I would fight for the definition of the problem. He who defines a problem solves it. He who defines an election wins it. And I'd take immigration for an example. I don't believe at the end of the day, and I may be totally wrong about this, that a majority of Americans or even a majority of Republicans, when given the opportunity to think about it with an adequate facts at their disposal, believe we should slam the door on the people of this world and become full-on nativist. And I would stand on those right. I'd fight for a free press.
If you just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Mac Stepanovich. So put yourself now in the position of a political advisor for progressive Democrats, okay? And I want you to think both of office holders and of citizen activists, because the Trump presidency has, at least in recent weeks, seem to have catalyzed quite an uptick in grassroots progressive activity. What tactical political advice would you be giving those two groups, both the office holders and the citizen activists, for their best political strategy right now?
I would advise them to continue to energize like-minded people to protest, to speak out on principle, not out of spite, not out of revenge, not out of meanness. I would not oppose Neil Gorsuch for the Supreme Court simply because Merrick Garland got a raw deal. I would try to be better than that. You know, I would grill him as much as he needed in the hearings, and then I would announce that I was going to vote for him because he was qualified and the president had the right to appoint him. I wouldn't, you know, it's like when Trump brought up torture. How do you win a war when you become like your enemies and you torture people? And so I would advise the Democrats to tap the brakes on the revenge and the anger and some of the more, what shall we say, vigorous progressive programs. If they want to draw me away from Trump, people like me, be steady. Again, don't change too fast. Don't frighten me. And don't, for example, say you're going to redistribute my income. You may want to talk about that later until we get this straightened out.
And I think you intimated this, but just want to be more specific on it. Do you think that the Democrats right now are running a danger of a strategy of constant objections, constant cries of outrage that then become kind of a background, political background noise to all of this? I mean, instead of picking battles?
I think it becomes more tit for tat, and it more deeply divides the nation and calcifies the differences we have now. We're going to fight everything. We're going to, you know, light ourselves on fire. We're going to lay in the road. We're going to boycott committee meetings. That just plays into all of the biases and all of the anger of their opponents. What if they were just a little more reasonable? Now, I know people are going to say, well, y'all weren't reasonable. You were mean and you were spiteful and you were petty. Okay, fine. Can you be better than that? Can you show us how to behave?
And you mentioned a football coach a minute ago. I want to run with that metaphor,
sure,
so to speak, for a minute. Thinking about this again, looking at the Democrats, thinking of yourself as a Republican strategist, who's the player you're most worried about? Okay. And what is the play that you're the most worried about? And defining play here as, I guess, a set of positions or a position that Democrats might push that you think could really hurt the Republicans.
You know, I don't know. Well, I would just give you an example. Someone I talked to recently mentioned Representative Maxine Waters. Mm-hmm. I don't know a lot about her, but I have an impression of her that's probably shared by many of my colleagues, that she is a leftist and more extremely so. Nancy Pelosi's the leader, but she's a little radioactive too. I would like the Democrats, and I don't know who it is, And I would be afraid of the person that they might come forward with, like Republican Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska or Jeff Flake from Arizona, a younger person with a more tempered voice and a better temperament and a more acceptable way of explaining policy positions. Right now, it looks like the Democrats are about to tee it up to act like Republicans. And I don't think that's going to help Republicans or Democrats.
So there's one political figure in this part of the country that sometimes is put on that list of a sort, I guess, and that's Kirsten Gillibrand. Is that someone who's crossed your radar screen as a Democrat that might?
Yeah, I know. I know who she, obviously know who she is, and I know something of her. And again, this is just stuff I absorb from the atmosphere. I can't, you know, nothing specific. She doesn't set my hair on fire as that kind of person. You know, talking about New Yorkers, Bill de Blasio, you know, makes it like fingers on a blackboard for me. But the governor, I'm not sure that he might not have a voice that might be worth listening to as long as he didn't, you know, go over the top. And that's what I think has to happen to reestablish a center. We have to reestablish trust in our leaders in both parties. And right now there's very little of it.
So you've just got about a minute and a half or so left. And I wanted to tap your particular expertise as a Floridian. Have we heard the last of Marco Rubio as a presidential hopeful? How would you assess his star?
I don't think so. I think that Marco is he's very young. He's very smart. He's very eloquent. He's able. And he's certainly ambitious. I think that as you watch him tack and trim his sails, you would have to conclude that he has another possible presidential candidacy in his future. I mean, all you have to do is read the statement on the immigration executive order that he and Tim Scott put out. It was a page full of nothing. So that you could subsequently say, well, I said this and then I was on the other side too and I'm the kind of guy you might like. I don't think that's the kind of guy that we need at the moment.
That was Mac Stepanovich. Mac, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, I appreciate you having me again.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Jason Smith. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.